Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. What is it that you can say in a 3-minute introduction about a writer who published over 70 books, lived nearly a century, and won almost every literary prize in the world, including the Nobel? I'm talking here about Doris Lessing. She was known as a political and social activist, but really, she is most important as one of the crucial novelists of the 20th century, and I mean that in a global sense. Lessing came to Portland in 1992, Bill Clinton had just been elected, having published the novel The Fifth Child in 1988. This talk is about the tension between art and commerce, or as she would say, the climate of commercialism in publishing. She traces the history of publishing from the 1950s through to the time of her talk. It's a reminder in an age of chain stores and online retailers that this tension has been a part of the industry for a very long time. More than any other art form, perhaps, literature lives at the crossroads of art, profit, and democracy. As Lessing notes in her talk, this can be troublesome at the best of times. Let's listen to one of the greatest writers of her generation, Doris Lessing.
First of all, I'm going to have to confess to you that I have one of the world's most disastrous colds which came on me on the airplane. So I'm in the same situation, I think, as half the people, certainly in Seattle, and probably here too, and absolutely in London. And I might even lose my voice altogether, which would give a whole new dimension to this evening. So I think I'm going to tell you about when this happened to me, when German television was coming at 10 o'clock one morning. I lost my voice at 6 in the morning, and nothing I would do would get it back. So when he arrived, this bloke with his team, I said, "Can't talk." He says, "Our author today will sound like our own Marlene Dietrich." So the only thing was, you see, I could either squeak or growl and nothing in between. But I never heard this, thank God, but I'm told it was quite one of the most bizarre broadcasts that they'd ever heard. What I'm going to do is to give an obviously somewhat inadequate survey of the machinery of the literary scene. That is the underpinning, not the glamorous part, but how it all works, because I am often quite astounded by people have a very romantic idea of it all. So I'm going to talk about the nuts and bolts. Everybody knows that the publishing scene is dominated by these enormous multinationals at the moment. This is all over the world, particularly in America and Britain. I'm sure that it will cause the young great amazement and nostalgia among the older people here when I remind you what publishing was like in the early 50s when I arrived in London. The scene then was that there were small independent publishers in both countries. Most of them were owned by one person. Some of them were left over from the 19th century. They were dedicated to literature, to producing good books, and they were extremely proud of what they did. I think probably the archetypal representatives are in your country, Knopf, Blanche and, what is his name? Alfred Knopf. And in London, Jonathan Cape. Jonathan Cape's backlist is like a list of all the great books of our time. It's quite astonishing. Now, I'm going to tell you about someone called Michael Joseph because in some ways he's rather representative. In the middle of the war, he was an agent. He didn't go to the war. There was something wrong with him. And he decided to be a publisher. Everybody, as usual, told him it was quite impossible. I mean, apparently they do this to everyone who wants to be a publisher. They said it was not possible to start a publishing firm on the amount of capital he had, which was minimal, and certainly not in the war. And he started it, and it was at once a great success, partly because, of course, he had been an agent, and he knew all the other agents. Now, what was interesting about that was that From the start, he was criticized for being a middlebrow publisher. Now, that is not a label or criticism that we made now to any publisher. We have a completely different list of priorities. It is interesting, too, that about 5 years ago, a publisher in England who hates what's going on in the publishing scene decided to start again an independent publishing firm. He raised £2 million, which might sound quite a lot of money, certainly did to me, but it turned out he was undercapitalized, and within about a year he had to sell out to one of the multinationals. Whereas Michael Joseph started, I think, on something like £20,000. Now, while most of these publishers published an occasional potboiler, most of them, in fact, were dedicated to having at least sort of like 95% of their lists literary books of a high quality, and they prided themselves on it. They prided themselves on excellence. I remember meeting a man who said, it stuck in my mind because I thought it was such a compliment. He said when he went into a library and he was in too much of a hurry to look for some individual book, he would automatically take any book published by Faber and Faber and Jonathan Cape because he knew it would be of a certain standard. Well, those were the days. Nobody could say that now. The policy of good publishers was then they would take on a writer. If it was a young writer, this writer was nursed along, kept in print, and the publisher's attitude was that if this writer didn't make it with the first book, they probably wouldn't a second or third or fourth. There was a joke in the early 80s, which was that quite soon they'd be saying that a shelf life of a book was whatever. And I remember certain cynical people like myself were saying that it wouldn't remain a joke for long, and we turned out, unfortunately, to be only too right. In those days, writers had a great loyalty to a publishing firm, particularly to an editor in the firm, because the heart of publishing is the relationship between an editor and an author. I don't think it's ever been properly described. It's a certainly very mysterious relationship. It's absolutely essential. It is very difficult for writers to write unless there is a sympathetic editor in that firm that you can get on with. The other little thing that one has to remember from those happy days, publishers sold books. The writers didn't have to. It never occurred to any writer or to any publisher that the writer would have to go out and sell books. The disadvantage of this extremely amiable scene was that the men who ran these publishing houses were not necessarily good businessmen. A passion for literature doesn't necessarily equip you for making a profit. That means that when the big multinationals came along and for some mysterious reason enormously rich millionaires decided to fall in love with publishing, all these publishing houses were there ripe to be taken over because most of them were in debt or didn't earn very much money. You will notice that I say businessmen. In those days, I don't think there were any women. Now, enormous numbers of women are in publishing, and some of the best publishers in Britain are women. There was another little thing that happened fairly early on, which we're still in the 50s, which then struck everybody as totally and utterly shocking, and it was this. Michael Joseph, unlike all his predecessors who went on being publishers for decades, did very well and decided to sell out. He was a bon viveur, he loved races and a good life, and okay, he was successful, and he decided to sell, and he sold I think it was to the London Illustrated, Illustrated London News. But the point was, he consulted with all his editors, every one, and they all agreed, and there was a clause in the contract which said that this firm could not be resold without consultation with the people in the firm, all of them. Well, there was a day when I was rung up by friends in the firm and told that they had heard that the firm had been sold over their heads, and they'd only knew about it because they'd heard it on the ticker tape. As I say, that struck everybody then as shocking. Now, it wouldn't be noticed. Then it also started to happen in the late 50s, the following. We would get letters, writers would get letters from some editor and say, you will have heard on the grapevine by now that I have left X and I'm moving to whatever. I will be so sorry not to be working with you, but perhaps we can have lunch very soon. In other words, will you please come with me? Now, the thing was, we did often move after the editors, which then appalled the publishing firms, but soon was taken for granted, because it is acknowledged that the relationship between an author and an editor is important. I, in fact, left a publishing firm for Knopf because my editor, Bob Gottlieb, moved to Knopf, and I left a publishing firm or two for Cape because a friend of mine, Tom Mashler, was in Cape, and this started to happen. But the scene was still apparently very much the same, and then suddenly everything changed because before our eyes we saw all these venerable publishing firms being bought up by big multinationals. They got bigger and bigger blocks of publishing firms. Now, when you ring up someone, you hear, instead of Jonathan Cape, you'll say, this is da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, about 15 firms. And you say, can I speak to so-and-so? And the girl says, who? This being the man who's been running it for 20 years. This is what's happening. It is all very discouraging. So now the scene is that accountants run the publishing firms, and everybody knows it. This means that the good publishers in these publishing firms, and there are many, all have a certain harried look about them and are disconsolate, and they've got every reason to be. Now, for example, there's a very good long novel. Long is important, by Niccolo Tucci, who wrote before my time, and another book called The Sun and the Moon had never been published in Britain. I think it's a marvelous book. I think it's a masterpiece. I don't like using this word lightly. So I undertake to try and get it sold in Britain, and I send it to one of the very few small firms left, Peter Owen, who runs perpetually on an overdraft, has one assistant, and produces these marvelous books. He's the last of the old guard. He read this book and said, I absolutely agree with you, but you know, if I published this book at this length, I really would have to go bankrupt. I'm sorry. Okay, try a big one. So I try one of the good big ones. I get the letter back. I absolutely agree with you. This is a great novel, but I'm very sorry I can't publish it. In other words, the accountants wouldn't allow it. I don't think it would have happened before. One of the old-fashioned publishers would have published it and taken it for granted that they would make a loss, knowing that this was a part of their job. This does not mean to say that there are not a lot of very good novels being written and published. There are. And I think that any good novel, though it might have quite a hard time, will finally end up by getting a publisher. I don't think there are any, I doubt that there's any novel around that is good and that doesn't find a publisher simply because of the desperate need of publishers to publish as many books as possible. God knows why. I think it must please the accountants and the great men who now own the publishing firms. What happens now is, in the great time in which we live, we now see the situation where the author is the author as personality, which you're now seeing in front of you. Young people present will be absolutely astounded to hear that there was once a time when authors were not seen, but they were only read. At the best, they might see their photographs in the newspaper. Now, how did all this start? I will tell you. It started because the publishers in the 50s and before hated spending any money on advertising. Back we come to my friend Michael Joseph, who I hadn't been one of his authors for longer than 3 months, and he took me out to lunch in order to explain to me that it was always folly to advertise because it didn't make any difference. What really mattered was this very mysterious factor X, which no one could describe, which meant that novels in some mysterious way got known about through word of mouth. And there was in the war a novel called The Snow Goose, which was reprinted several times before publication on word of mouth alone. I do not really feel that this is a very useful example for ordinary affairs, but all publishers will explain to you how useless it is to advertise novels, which doesn't prevent them from advertising novel if one is already doing well. This is what is interesting. Apparently, this is the law that is used in the army, which I read about. If a general is conducting a war, where you send your troops is always to the bit of the war that is doing well, and you let the others sink and swim. Well, this principle is used by publishers. They will spend a lot of money on publishing a book that has taken off, but I'll explain it to all the other authors that it's really reviews that do it. Authors are always asking, you know, in our feeble way, if advertising is sometimes good, why is it not always good? The publishers have always, right from the start, tried to get their authors, that is back in the 50s, into the newspapers in some way or another, because it doesn't cost them anything, you know. You get pages and pages in a newspaper, and it hasn't cost the publisher a penny. What it has cost is the author's time and nerves, but this has never counted. Several things came together. Once was the situation that, one was that the publishers would never spend money on advertising, was always trying to promote their authors in other ways, and the sudden proliferation of the media, the television that is always hungry, radio that is always hungry, and these things all came together, and suddenly you find that in the contract, you may find that the author has contracted to do promotion. Now, we joke, you see, in our usually feeble way, that first we have to write the book and then we have to sell it. And I remember when I joked to my publisher that I was about to join his sales department, he thought this was in very, very poor taste. But this is, in fact, what happens. We join the publisher's sales department. Now, I can illustrate the bad side of this by our biographer, Michael Holroyd, who is, after all, a somewhat serious person. I met him in Toronto at one of these book fairs. I walked into the room, and there was Michael Holroyd with this kind of look of incandescent exhaustion, which I'm only too familiar with. I said, "Michael, what's the matter?" And he says, his publicity girl from the publishing firm had sent him down to three towns that separately from Toronto. In one, the interviewer, television, was under the impression he was married to Lynn Reed Banks instead of Maggie Brabble. And the whole of the time was spent with him saying, "Well, actually, I'm not really married to Lynn Reed Banks." The other one was cancelled as he arrived. They hadn't bothered to cancel it, so it saved him the journey. And the third one, the interviewer was under the impression he was someone else. Now, this is only too common. Now, once upon a time, you see, when this era, the great era we live in, dawned, the editors, publishers, and PR girls are really quite embarrassed about all this. Now it is taken absolutely for granted that all this should go on. And when you turn up, you travel across the country to sign books, and you find that the publisher has forgotten to get the books there, the PR girl will say, "Oh, I'm sorry. We forgot, but it's all right. Well, come and have a drink." This is now the tone of everything, I'm afraid. In other words, what is never costed is the author's time. Now, I wrote a letter to this effect to my main publishers recently and said, had it ever crossed their mind to cost the author's time? They were faintly embarrassed because, of course, they had never crossed their mind to think of this. So one has to remind them that what writers need is quiet. All writers need to be quiet. We need, in fact, to be rather bored. We need to be unstimulated. We spend large quantities of our time alone, solitary, slopping about somewhere, probably in a dressing gown. This is what we need. This is the last thing that publishers these days are interested in. Now I must tell you, of course, there's no such thing as a villain. There are no villains in this scene. It started off in the 50s with this meanness of the publishers about advertising, and it's, as I say, coincided with these hungry media, and it has grown to where we are now. And you can't say it was anybody's fault. It just happened. But I sometimes do remember that when The Grass Is Singing came out, and I think it was 51, it got good reviews, and there was a nasty paper in those days called The Daily Graphic, and they wanted me to write articles supporting hanging, flogging, and the forcible retention of the colonies. And when I said, but look, you know, I don't agree with any of this, they look at me and they say, I can hear them thinking, what's she on about? She's going to get her book noticed. This was then, it was very much the first swallow of a summer. So now, every year, these floods of books get published. A lot of people think too many books are published. But on the other side of the argument is that very often, publishers will take a chance on 10 books, let's say, hoping that one, two, or three of them will make it. And this is, in fact, what happens. And there's another thing that can happen, that a book will come out at the wrong time for the book, like Under the Volcano by Lowry. It got no notice at all when it first came out. Then something fitted, and it became what it has been since. One of the fine books of our time. Another thing that happens is that a writer will write one, two, or three quite ordinary books. And an example of this is Salman Rushdie, who wrote a not terribly exciting book, Grimus, and then wrote Midnight's Children, which I think is one of the great books of our time. So this is one of the things which that goes on, which I don't think is necessarily to the benefit of literature. And you have to fight every inch of the way, I assure you. You have to fight to be a writer at all against the publishers. Another thing that is inevitable, unavoidable, and difficult, it is that because of the difficulty of drawing attention to books, all publishers want authors to write puffs for novels they're producing, as a result of which one might easily get 9 or 10 books a week. Now, I'd like to ask if any one of you present could easily read 9 or 10 books a week. Now, what happens is that the poor old writer is in a permanent state of guilt because we know perfectly well that among these 9 or 10 books, there might very well be a good book, and it might very well disappear entirely without notice. And what it has to have is some kind of attention from someone that, you know, a well-known writer has to say, I have read this book and I think it's good. Otherwise, it's quite possible it won't be noticed at all. Therefore, you're always sitting on the floor, surrounded by books, reading hastily through this book, thinking, oh my God, I'm very wicked. If I don't read this book, I can easily be consigning some unfortunate new writer to permanent oblivion, this kind of thought. This is very wearing on the nerves, actually. So that's another thing. I have to say we reached a new turn of the screw this last week when I had a very tart fax from a publisher saying that she had sent me such and such a book 3 months ago. She hadn't heard from me, and she trusted she would hear from me by return of post. This is a new development. The other thing is that all writers are part of the machinery, the literary machinery, in that we all sit on the juries for literary prizes, of which there are now very many, and we often are parts of... We are on committees for various literary reasons, for the arts councils and things like this. We're always writing puffs, I mean, long pieces of work to please our publishers for some book or other that we're interested in. All this work, of course, is completely unpaid and makes us, I think, a totally unnoticed part of the machinery because all this is taken for granted. Now, the Booker Prize was started by a very clever publisher, namely Tom Mashler, who persuaded Booker Connell to pay for this prize. And no bones at all were made about the fact that this was a selling thing. We should remember the origins of things, just as we should remember that the shelf life of this book is 3 months began as a joke. We should remember that the Booker Prize began as a means to sell more books, because otherwise one gets immersed in swamps of sentimentality. The other thing that happens with this conveyor belt situation with literature, you know, everything is geared to the 3 months selling period. The book comes out, the sales department, everything is geared for 3 months intensive selling. That means that you feel as if you're on some kind of a roller coaster. You get that over with, you've gone on your promotion tours, and then you see what they want is another book very quickly because they want to cash in on the momentum of this process. So you will start. It will start. Hi, Doris, I was just wondering how you were getting on. I'm fine, fine. And how's your new book? Oh, fine, fine. You wouldn't like, perhaps, to give me a title so we could put it in the autumn catalogue. Well, it hasn't got a title yet. All right. So I won't bother you. Okay, fine, next week. Hi, Doris. You know, I think of you all the time. How is it going? I say, I really would like to take my time over this one. You're absolutely right, absolutely, quite right, next week, and so on. And now I'm going to cheer you all up with good news, which is from one end of Europe to the other, and for all I know in America too, there is a completely new phenomenon, that is in the last 15 years, and that is the book fairs and festivals which have started. There are new ones every year, they are enormously successful, they attract more and more people, and everybody has a very good time at them, including the authors, because it's all very jolly. And I thought I might tell you about some of them because, of course, there's nothing to stop anybody here going to any of them. So I will tell you about first and foremost is the one in Toronto, which you probably know about since it's so close, run by this extremely, well, it isn't very far looking at it from the perspective of London. It's run by an extremely efficient man called Greg Gatenby. And it's by far the best organized of the book fairs, not least because he takes an immense amount of trouble to promote and look after new writers. A new writer going to this book fair will find that as much attention is paid to him or her as to the established writers. Then there is the Adelaide Festival in Australia, which is a long way off, but I assure you that it's wonderful. Hay on Wye in England, which is on the Welsh border, is very laid back, slightly amateur, charming and marvelous. You might find yourself parked on remote farmhouses where you make friends for life because there isn't enough room in the town for everyone. Cheltenham, which gets better and better every year, Edinburgh every second year, Gothenburg in Sweden, which is a very big one and very successful. The most charming one of them all is in Barcelona, where they've always had something called a book day, and in the past, the women gave men books and the men gave women roses. This no longer being acceptable, everybody gives everything to everybody. So from early in the morning, the whole town is awash with red roses, and there are books from one end of the city to the other, and it's absolutely wonderful. Everyone gets drunk around about 6 or 7, and it's a great party, and I recommend it absolutely. Now, in Italy, they have festivals and book prizes from one in every town, and when you murmur to an Italian friend that perhaps, that this is an awful lot of prizes, they say, yes, but it's extremely good for the tourist trade, which of course it is, and I recommend you to any town in Italy has a festival going sometime in the year. Now, there's another thing that happened. I'm glad it looks to me as if it might be fading out. This is bad news, not good news. This is when an author suddenly gets an invitation from the mayor of somewhere, like Stuttgart or Berlin or somewhere, to go to with a whole lot of other writers to pronounce on, as it might be, whither the bomb or how about pollution or whatever. What do you think is the worst thing in the world today? And you think, you really feel important. Then it occurs to you to remember that no politician or mayor has ever cared ever for what any writer has to say. What is actually happening is that this very, very clever mayor is doing a very good publicity stunt for his city. Because, of course, if the city has a whole lot of writers spilling about for a week, having a lot of thoughts about the state of the world, it's extremely good for the city. And so this, I'm glad to say, looks as if it's fading out, because I thought it was a particularly phony one. But maybe it'll be going on. I hope not. Now, what is happening? I just wanted to make sure that nobody thought it was only the authors that were being badly treated. The publisher, the editors in these firms are not treated well. For example, when Granada sold its publishing firm to Collins, it then was not what it is now, I happened to be having lunch that day with someone in the firm, and as I walked in, I saw that everyone was literally shaking with shock. They had just been told by the boss that the firm had been sold and that they were to take all their desks across to the other firm by 6 o'clock that night, treating these people as if they were some kind of what? I mean, it was so callous. What goes on is so brutal and so stupid that you can't exaggerate it. It's stupid because editors, after all, the good ones, care about books. This is what makes them good editors and publishers. Treat it like dispensable rubbish, they stop doing their best, which you'd think even accountants might be able to work out, but it seems not. Several times I have been observed or been on the edge of when authors decide not to put up with any of this any longer and start their own publishing firms. This has never worked in my experience because what happens is this, since writers want to write, they then employ someone to run the publishing firm. So you have a publishing firm with the writers in their usual position of wanting to be left in peace to get on with it. Then everything might work like a dream, but then you come to the distribution as anyone who's had anything to do with publishing knows, distribution is the problem. You can produce a beautiful book, but if you haven't got the distribution machinery, you can't sell it. Now, all the big publishers have marvelous distribution machinery, which means that these little amateur publishing authors firms at once go bust or go back bust extremely soon. Now, I've said that a lot of very good books are published, and there are. There are also a lot of books that are not very good and could be better, I maintain, because of this climate of commercialism. And I want to quote two examples. One was, and I get a letter from an Israeli woman saying that she had a child whom, that she had to support, that she had to get up at 6 a.m. to write. She had a terrible time, but she was determined to write the equivalent of War and Peace. And she then sent me a great wad of material together with a synopsis of all the rest of this book. And in that was the most wonderful material you can imagine. I mean, most writers would give their eye teeth to have this kind of experience. The only thing was about the bit that she sent was she had written it in a burst. She was full of talent, full of energy, but she had not done enough work on it, which happens more and more. You get these books, talent, energy, but you can see that it's never been rewritten. The author's probably never looked at it from the moment she put down her word processor. Another example, which is very much worse, this time it's an editor in a very good publishing firm who wrote a book and was sent to me, and again, energy, talent, the lot, and you could see that she'd never once looked at it since she'd finished it. She just wrote it. I wrote back and I said, you know, this is going to be a very good book when you rewrite it. And she said, but I can't rewrite it because I need the money. Now, the thing is, this would have been inconceivable a few years ago. The climate has changed so that the priorities are different. You don't need to feel a responsibility to make whatever it is as good as possible. That has changed. And I'm not going to do more than just mention this, but it's just possible that the word processor may have something to do with it, because it is so easy to write, so easy to make it look good, but it doesn't mean to say that it shouldn't be rewritten. Whatever the reason, you get a very great many books, any writer does, that are nearly good and are not good and could be with a bit more work. I think it might be valuable to remind ourselves what literature once was. There was once a phenomenon called the cultivated person, man or woman. This person, anywhere in Europe, was taught the classics, that's Greek and Latin, the literature of their own country, and possibly one or two masterpieces from another European country and a book or two from Japan or somewhere like that. And the idea was that this would give this person some means of judging life, some discrimination, some way of examining their lives. And I think it might be as well to remember here that women who were never sent to school at some point often educated themselves entirely in the libraries, and Virginia Woolf was one of them. I was remembering, thinking about this, what was put at the beginning of the Everyman's books, this marvelous series of classical books. It goes, "Every man, I will be your guide. In your most need, be by your side." Well, that used to be the spirit. And another aspect of it was that is the link between the humanistic education and other branches was when we remember that doctors, the medical education in Russia has always been linked with a literary education, and it was this that produced Chekhov and other writers. I have hardly mentioned politics, and I'm just going to skitter through it because time is running out. And because, actually, it's all written down. There was a Well, so it's time for everyone. There was a conference in Rutgers in April this year, when the Partisan Review, together with Rutgers, organized this conference. It was called Intellectuals and Social Change in Central and Eastern Europe. And I'm glad to say they invited me, because I've never had a more fascinating time in my life, because these were these people who had run Samizdat, fought the old communist regimes, had been in prison, exiled, you name it. It had happened to them. Here they all were. They were there because of the reputation of the Partisan Review. And for purpose of this talk, the interesting thing was that the university is much bedeviled by political correctness. And these people who had lived through political correctness, but which is the father of communism is the father or mother of political correctness, were absolutely astounded that anyone should be prepared to listen for 5 minutes to any such rubbish. And we came to the conclusion that the human race indeed cannot learn anything if, after 70 years of seeing what the ideologues had done for literature in the Soviet Union, all the Eastern European countries, if after that we were still prepared to have to listen to people running around with political recipes for correct writing and reading, then we deserve all we get, seemed to be the feeling, and I feel that perhaps they might be right. Now, in an atmosphere where this happened when I was talking somewhere, I remarked quite innocently that Nuruddin Farah, he's the Somali writer, I said he'd written wonderfully about women, and that few people had ever written better about women than he, at which a whole row of women got up from the front and made an ostentatious exit. Now, the fact that he was black, you see, that was a good mark, but he was a man, so that was a bad mark. But unfortunately, he was still, it was not possible to say that a man could write well about women. And against this kind of stupidity, I think there is very little defense except patience. This is one of these big hysterical movements which luckily do not last for long. They go raging past and start seeming, even to their believers, fairly ridiculous quite soon. I know that this is an enormous subject, and I could talk about it for hours, but I think that the time has come for questions, if not least because my voice is beginning to sound extremely peculiar. There's a question here. I have read that you might do a sequel to The Fifth Child, and is this true? This was, it's quite interesting, this question. The Fifth Child did extremely well in Germany, and it was on the bestseller list for weeks. It's very interesting what countries books succeed in. And the German publishers, naturally enough, said, what a good idea to have a sequel to The Fifth Child. And it never crossed my mind, you see, ever. But when I began to think about it, it's a very interesting thought, because the question is, in what kind of culture could this creature be accepted? And you go back, I went back to the beginning of when I started to think about writing The Fifth Child. You can't have this child born into a slum or a favela somewhere, because there's no dramatic excitement in it. Somebody born like that would hardly be noticed in the general poverty and misery. So it would have to be born into a middle-class family. But if I were to write a sequel, it occurred to me that the interesting thing about this would be, we know what's the matter with Ben, namely that he's some throwback to the remote past, but he doesn't know this. He doesn't know anything about himself. All he knows is that he doesn't fit in anywhere, and he's not like anyone else. He's got a kind of a dumb hunger. Now, this seems to me the human condition, really. We all of us feel, it seems to me, exiled, from something or other. And I thought that if I were actually to find a way of doing it, it might be quite interesting. But the disadvantage is that the sequel would be quite different in tone from the first one, because sequels usually are. They're written at a different time, from a different impulse, and it's a different kind of thing. So the people who like The Fifth Child will not like the sequel. This you know before you start. But they, on the other hand, the people who like the sequel might not like The Fifth Child. But it could be an absolute heartbreaker if I did it. But of course, I haven't done it. I'm doing something else. I'm actually writing my autobiography, Vol 1. And the reason I know that I'm doing this is because I found that I had written a folder, and on it I had written Autobiography, Vol 1, and I had written 3 pages, which seemed to me that I must be writing my autobiography. So I don't think I can write Volume 2. That's a problem, because that would be from the time I arrived in London. And I have known a great many of the well-known people of our time, and I cannot understand how anybody can write truthful autobiographies. I mean, I think it was Simone de Beauvoir who said she had no intention of writing the truth about certain things. Well, this is one way of doing it. I could say, you have to accept that this is half fiction, in which case, why not just write a novel? But, so anyway, whenever I think about writing my Volume 2, I just give up. But I am writing Volume 1, and that is interesting, because you realize just how much has just slipped slightly out of your mind and can be got back again quite easily. So anyway, that's what I'm doing. So God knows when I'll ever get round to that, if I ever do. It says here, do I use a word processor? No, I don't, but I keep meaning to. The thing is that I've got a superstitious feeling about this business. I think I'm like the character in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Machines and I do not get on. But I'm very happy with my fax. It's a very good relationship I have with my fax. So perhaps I can risk a word processor. What criteria can be applied to literature to decide what is worthy of print and distribution? Who is qualified to make these decisions? Well, as you will see, this is a lot of very important questions. I don't think books should be banned, but on the other hand, my principles do get rather stretched when I look at some of the pornography around, and I do think that this is that violent television and violent books help to create violence and crime. I do. I know this is not, we're not supposed to believe this, but I'm sure it is. If advertising has an influence, why not violence, sex, etc., and so forth? This I'm talking about the television. About books, the trouble about that is that the question about who is qualified to make these decisions, exactly who is qualified. Because if I want to ban a book, somebody else will say, right, well, you ban that one, then you can ban the one I don't like. And this is inevitable. So I think on the whole, better not ban anything. It says, what advice would you have for my 12-year-old daughter who wishes to be a writer? Well, my advice is exactly the same as for anybody who wants to be a writer, which is that they should be prepared to do a lot of hard work, because I think that a lot of people imagine that because all you need to be a writer is a pencil and a piece of paper, that the rest is easy. But in actual fact, you need to do a lot of work and you need to tear things up. I have to say that I tore up the African Laughter. I had to rewrite it completely. I'm not giving advice I don't take myself. I'm always tearing things up and starting again. And I think that people don't work hard enough. Again and again I say, how about throwing this away and doing something else? But it doesn't seem to happen, and which is interesting. It's the amateur approach. You never find professional writers sitting on something like a precious egg, you know. they throw things away and start again, or they try a different approach. So my advice to this girl, so if she's here, good luck. Practice. And remember that you can't write well without having read well. The way writers learn to be good writers is because you read a lot of very good books, and unconsciously this gets into you, and you acquire discrimination, and you get a sense of values. It's exactly the same as with painters, who might copy 5 or 6 painters' styles before it all mysteriously comes together and they acquire their own style. So that's my advice. Okay. Thank you.
That was Doris Lessing speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 1992. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.